session number 30416, Mr. John Taylor, Reel 4. Now, what happened when you got to Derby? You were in, what was the name of the camp you were in?
Collindale, I think it was called.
Collindale.
Yes, and it was a tented camp outside Durban. And
what were you doing there?
Waiting, basically, to be posted to a training camp.
Now, what were conditions? What were your first impressions of South Africa? You know, because it's very foreign for most English people at that time who hadn't been anywhere. You know, and you're at the other end of the world, and you're in South Africa. What did you think of it? What impression did it all make on you?
Very good indeed. I mean, after all the rationing and things in England, and all the blackouts and everything, to go to a place where they got fairly modern buildings, white tall buildings all round the port. They'd got things like the Red Triangle Club, which was a Salvation Army club, and you could go there and have lovely slap up meals for about sixpence. In fact, again, most of it got dysentery in the first week, or at least it got the runs.
Upset tummy.
Upset tummies from all the fruit. Because, you know, fruit galore.
And what were conditions like in the camp? There was a tented camp. What was it like?
Awful. You know, you're sleeping 12 to a tent with your feet towards the pole. And I remember one day something wriggling on my chest. And instinctively went like that, and grabbed it, closed my hand on something, squeezed and threw it. And in the morning there was a big spider outside where I'd crushed and thrown outside. But then in the morning I had to fold up the walls of the tent and let the air go through. But as I say, we got time off. The only thing is...
Were you doing any training or drill, or were you just living there?
Just living there, I think. I can't remember doing any drill.
What about, South Africans, were they hospitable, the civilians? Because sometimes they were. It depends which bit you were.
It was whether they were English or Afrikaner. The English, you'd be walking along and a car, open top car with two girls in the back would draw up and the bloke would say, are you going anywhere, boys? You know, would you like to come for a drive? And he'd take us out to lunch with his daughters, that kind of thing. The Afrikaners were a bit surly. Some were nice, some were all right, but there were all sorts of stories about servicemen being on their own being caught by Afrikaners and ill-treated. But
what form did their surliness take, if you see what I mean? Or did you not personally experience it?
I didn't personally experience it. In fact, later on, I'll tell you that I used to go to a little village.
We'll hold it, yeah. So anything else? What else are you doing while you're there, then? I mean, basically, just living in fairly bad conditions, as far as I can see.
Yes, but we used to go into the town, but when a convoy was in, all the pubs closed at 6 o'clock. Instead of staying open till 10, because of the bad behaviour of some of the troops, especially the Australians, when they hit the town. But we'd always got the naffy kind of places to go to. And I went to a place called Monkey Island once, one afternoon, which... a whole lot of monkeys there playing about and you could feed them and whatnot. So, you know, for a 19-year-old lad, it was quite interesting.
Would you go dancing or drinking or cinemaing in Durban?
No, not there. I think I did go to the cinema.
May have been a camp cinema.
Well, we've been to the camp... You know, we often used to go to the camp cinema, but the cinemas were very different from the first time I ever went to a cinema in South Africa. You'd think you were in a medieval castle courtyard, because all round you could see the silhouette of the castle walls and things and the turrets. The sky was a blue sky covered with stars and clouds drifting across, and yet it was all inside the cinema. And then halfway through the big picture it just suddenly stopped, and everybody got up and went to the bar. They had an interval just like a theatre, and that's where I learnt to drink this liqueur, cherry liqueur, because it was ever so cheap out there.
So how long are you there for? You start you start at 41 Air School in November, so it sounds like you were there about a month. I don't know
if it was as long as a month, 2 to 3 weeks at the most. And then we were posted to East London, which is another port, but it had an airfield. And that was where I first flew.
Now, is this the 41 Air School then?
Yes.
And what's the name of the airfield, or is it just East London Airfield?
We just called it East London, I think.
Now, so what was the setup when you got there?
We were in, I think we were in huts, wooden huts, and the classrooms were in wooden huts. And there's a lot more navigation now, because we're actually going to fly. And
well, how did it develop? It's always quite difficult, but I mean, what have you moved on to, or was it just more of the same?
Well, we were flying, and that made the big difference. You've got your theory.
So you'd have theoretical lectures on the ground.
Yes, yes.
And how were they progressing?
You were doing a lot more, as I say, this navigation on the climb, where you had to find the wind at different heights and then take an average of it to calculate what your position was, because you'd have, in a way, you crossed would not be different from where you intended. So you got the wind on the climb from that.
Anything else new, or was it? Of course, you can just be learning the same thing,
yes,
just moving through it.
But the big thing was flying for the first time.
Well, tell me about your what do you remember about your first flight?
Well, you know, went out to these Ansons, and they were flying classrooms, they used to call them, to engined aircraft with windows all round. The cockpit was right from the front to the back, and he had three navigators to an aircraft. And the pilots were South African, so they captains and lieutenants in the South African Air Force. And the first navigator navigated. Forget what the second one did, but the third navigator hadn't even got a seat. He sat on his parachute, and it was his job to wind up the undercarriage, which went up by hand, and about 150 turns to raise the undercarriage, and the same thing when you were coming down again. But
and what would you do in these navigation training flights?
Well, you were taught square searches over the sea, which, if you're looking for a ship that's lost or a dinghy that's lost,
now how do you do it? So tell me about that. Because that's new. You haven't mentioned that before. What's the theory of a square search? Is it just you?
Well, you've got to cover the ground, cover the sea, the area, to your limit of observation. So the tracks are so far apart that you could see on each side. But you've also got to be able to keep track of where you are, which over a featureless ocean is difficult. So that's what we've taught. I can't remember now exactly the technicalities of it,
but you learnt it.
Yeah, I know. We're very pleased when after we'd finished, we had to set course for crossing the coast at a certain point, and as it came in sight, I remember when I was navigating, the pilot, oh bloody hell, you know, there it is, right on track.
So that was pretty difficult.
Yes, yes.
Now, what else were you learning? Or were you doing up and... Now, I mean, you'd be doing...
We did cross-countries.
Now, tell me about cross-country exercises. What were they like?
Well, you set off, and you'd have to fly to, say, Port Elizabeth, and then across to Grahamstown, and back to East London, and you're doing all the navigation, finding pinpoints.
So all the things you've been taught.
You were applying them. And, of course, you're having to keep a chart, dead reckoning chart. That's where everything...
Now, can you explain a dead reckoning chart? I mean, that's...
Well, we haven't got any of these aids that they've got nowadays. So you started off from a known point, and you found the wind, and so in theory, you knew your track over the ground. And so you drew it in on your chart. Now, when it came to a certain pinpoint you recognised, or you got a wireless bearing that gave you a bearing and a position, then you put that in on your chart and started your dead reckoning again from that point. So your dead reckoning got more less and less accurate the further you were away from your last positive fix.
But it's where you'd record your calculations of all the other things.
It was all written down on your chart, and that was marked when you got back, of course. You were assessed on your ability. And at the end of that, we had an exam, a written exam, on all meteorology and everything else we'd learned.
Now, anything else you were doing? So you do cross-country flights. You've got, you've done your sea searches. What else are you doing? You have to do any photography at all?
Yes, yes.
Because I know they did do.
Yes.
It's not a big part of what you were doing, but I believe they did do photographic exercises. Can you tell us about them?
Yes, we had a big handheld camera that, so you leaned out of window with it holding it pointing downwards, and you had to take a series of pictures one after another, and then of course you had to bring the aircraft round to take a parallel strip, so you were photographing it in strips.
So you'd have would they overlap?
Yes.
So when you put them down, the overlapping photographs, you'd have a picture or a sort of photographic map of the ground.
Yes.
And they were meant to overlap one way and then back the other way, so that it all fitted together.
Oh, yes.
Now, that sounds very difficult, to be honest.
Mm.
Was it timed by a stopwatch or just by guesswork? Or do you not remember?
We'd got navigation watches by that time, which they'd issued us with, and they were very good. And they got stopwatches on them, and they'd got a movable outer bezel that you could swing round. What else? Anyway, they were very, very good. In fact, Grace's ambition was to get one home with you. But they were always very
watches.
Careful. The watches, yes, very careful to collect them in.
Any other type of mission or exercise they sent you on in the air?
Well, not a lot. I mean, the thing I remember most about South Africa was that, first of all, I made some friends with somebody on the beach, and they used to take me home.
A South African?
Yes, South African. He was manager of the OK Schutz stores in East London. And we used to go to what they call the bioscope there. And I was very intrigued with the bioscope in East London because it had a shelf right down the seats in front of you. And you could have refreshments brought to you. And
so you got on well with the civilians there?
Yes, the English.
Again, you're making a difference.
Yes.
Now, what about apartheid, which was partially in, partially not in? Were you aware of it, and how did you react to it? Because times were different then, so I'm not getting anything.
No, I didn't see much of it in East London, not till I got to Cape Town, not any later.
Right, so let's leave it till Cape Town.
Yes, but one day, notice on the camp board that Mrs. Butler and the farm would be glad to entertain. So I went, I put my name down, just me, and I caught the train along the Cape Peninsula to Berlin. And it was, they lived at Killamer, which was a farm 2 miles outside Berlin, which was a little hamlet, little village. And he got three daughters. And they were like a second, Mrs. Butler, like a second mother to me. And they got native servants. And they'd also got, the natives lived in a kraal, the straw huts with mud floors at the foot of the farm. But every now and again they had a beer festival in aid of raising money for the boys up north, which were fighting in North Africa. And they used to have auctions, and they used to get me to be the auctioneer. And Dutch auctions, you start high and come down until somebody bids and buys it. And we're all drinking gins and stuff. And the Kaffirs were drinking their Kaffir beer that they brewed. But all very jolly, have a big bonfire. And a little boy on the farm used to play with, there was a Afrikaner family lived in the village that were very friendly with. And they were very nice family, the Papis. And this little four-year-old, Luke, he could gabble with the natives in their language. It was a language of cliques, or Makossas, the Makossas, I think. And he could talk in Afrikaans, he could talk in English. He was trilingual even at that age. But, so, a very happy time in South.
Now, what were your actual conditions of service? I should have asked you. I mean, you were in huts, were you? I think you said everything was huts.
Yes,
we're in. What were your living conditions like out there?
Well, the food was good. We got time off. We could go swimming and surfing. I've got a picture of me in one of my albums with a surfboard. And then, of course, again at weekends, everything shut down, and we went off. I think I spent Christmas with the Butlers at Killamer, and we went onto the beach on Christmas Day, and I got sunburnt, and I didn't report it because it would be self-inflicted injury. I'd gone to sleep under a sun umbrella, and the sun had moved round. But we still had Christmas pudding and turkey on the blazing hot day, and all the flies and clouds above. But it was.
So it was. You enjoyed the time out there.
Yeah, it was a lovely time out there.
Did you fly in anything else but Anson's?
No, not out there. The Cape Peninsula has had an electric railway running right up the Cape, stopping at places like Heisenberg and things, and that was nice. You could go up there and go into one of the hotels and have an ice cream or something. And it was like being on holiday with the added excitement of flying.
Now, what about the exams? Because you pass out as a sergeant navigator.
Yes.
Now, there's an option, isn't there, of there's failing, but there's also, you could have passed out as an officer, I presume, or was that not an option?
It was an option, but when we were interviewed, the fact that I'd gone to a grammar school, not public school, the fact that I'd never played games went against me, and the fact my father was a furniture dealer. so I didn't get commissioned.
Well, did you feel reasonably aggrieved at that? Because that's not particularly relating to your competence as a navigator, or indeed as a crew member. That's relating to your background. Did you mind, or was it very much part of the time?
Well, only a few of them were commissioned. The bulk of the course were made sergeants. And to somebody that had been an AC two not many months before, to be a sergeant was quite something. Yes, and made it.
Did you think you'd be commissioned eventually? Because a lot of them were eventually. But I mean,
yes, so was I eventually.
I can see you really good. Yeah. Did you think you would be, or do you quite happy to be a sergeant while you wait? Or?
Well, I was always ambitious, so I'd always thought that one day I might be.
Now, this happened in February 43, you pass out, or it looks, I'm going from your record of service here, which isn't exactly precise about dates, but it's got them on. The next thing is that you go to advanced flying unit.
Before that, we went down.
You've got to get back first.
Went down to Cape Town.
Now, what happens there?
And at Cape Town, again, we were just billeted in a camp outside the...
Do you know its name?
...town. No, I don't.
Now, what happens there? Because this is where you do see the apartheid system you mentioned a bit.
Yes, and I was a bit shocked. I saw on the pavement one day a white woman. She said to another passerby, "Excuse me, where's the museum?" And a black bloke passing said, "Down there, missy, on the left." And this bloke turned around, swiped him one. "Don't you dare talk to white missy." And that did shake, surprised me. And
do you see any other signs that you didn't like, or?
There were stories we heard about the Afrikaner blokes seizing people on their own and tying them behind the cars and pulling them along. But I never saw anything of that.
Black people, not servicemen.
No, white servicemen.
Were these rumours?
Yes.
As far as you were concerned?
Yes, they were, and they were not service people, they were civilian Afrikaners. The Voortrekkers, the farmers.
So it's English South Africans they were attacking? Or English families?
It was English servicemen.
So they're attacking English servicemen.
Yes.
Were you warned to be careful? Or?
Yes, we were warned to be careful. Warned to keep together in groups. And we also were told we mustn't go down to District 6 at night, which is the native quarter of Cape Town, because all sorts of murders and things went on down there. And there was one time when we were all issued with revolvers and had to stand across the road because some of the natives from the camp had gone down to the town and had their way with some of the women, and a whole crowd of civilian blacks were marching up the road to wreak their revenge, and we had to stand
civilian
there.
Civilian South Africans?
Yes, native civilian South Africans. I think the impression me about the South Africans and the army that guarded the camp and that sort of thing, how they enjoyed drill for its own sake. They were always beautiful, everything polished, and they would march up and down for fun, drilling each other. And they guarded the camp with the assegais, these big spears. But we still got out under the wire. And while I was in Cape Town, that had a New Year's Eve party at the town hall, and we went down there.
Now, that's because you were still at number 41 school in December.
No, I said we went down to Cape Town. Oh, yes. I didn't tell you how we got to Cape Town, did I? No.
Ah, so you broke out. Right, okay. Because you're at the course. Until
I said to Cape Town, and then you asked me about apartheid. But we went on the train from East London to Cape Town.
This is, you're right.
And it took 3 days on the train, because we had to go right up into Johannesburg and right down again to get to Cape Town. But we were in sleeping cars, and it was an interesting journey, a bit boring though, after seeing nothing but the veld going by and everything.
Now, we were actually at Cape Town when you're leaving the course, you know, when you finish the course.
Yes.
You
go back.
How long were you there before you get a ship back? Because I presume that's what you're waiting for a ship.
Yes,
back.
About 2 weeks, I think, 2 to 3 weeks.
Now, what and about the voyage back? What ship were you on?
I can't remember the ship. It might have been something called the Mariposa. It was an American ship. And whereas I got visions of being in the sergeant's mess, they didn't have any such thing on this American ship. It was classless. And you went into a meal, and there was a shelf at standing height. You had tin trays with compartments, and the cook put everything into different trays, and then he took it there and ate standing up. And that was, oh dear, I thought it was going to be so different. And the American troops just got everything, they mixed it all up together into the central compartment and got a fork, opened the mouth and went revolving the fork and shooting it into their mouths. 2 minutes flat and the meal was done.
Now, which way did you come back? I mean, do you remember the route back? Or were you in convoy? What's going on?
I think we were alone, and I think we came at speed. Because it didn't take more than 2 weeks, I think, to get back.
And do you know when you got back? It looks like it might have... Because there seems to be a gap. You finish one course in February.
Yes.
And then there's a bit of time at Cape Town. And then the next course doesn't start till... June, I think. You don't start at Milham till June. Yes.
Now, when we got down, we were sent to Harrogate, and we're in the Grand Hotel at Harrogate.
And what are you doing there?
Mainly finding things to keep us occupied, like drill, you know. Lessons and lectures.
So this is for a couple of months?
But only in the mornings. Yes, and it was a very nice couple of months because they had the holidays at home. And Harrogate had got the hotels that weren't full of servicemen were full of civil servants from London, evacuated from London. All these young ladies, clerks and things. And had dancing in the Valley Gardens. And of course we felt pretty affluent, being sergeant's pay now. And in fact it was in there that I was coming back to coming back for lectures, that's right, on the way back. And the little chappie was standing on the pavement with the lady, dressed very smartly. And he said, "Excuse me, Sergeant," he said, "have you a moment?" He said, "we're getting married and haven't got a best man. Would you be best man?" And so I said to the two lads who were with me, "can you cover for me if I'm not here?" And they said, "we'll try." So I went into this registry office, and they got married, and he'd booked places at the hotel for the wedding breakfast and took me out there, and so I had a very nice wedding breakfast, and I got back, they hadn't missed me.
Now, you mentioned lectures. Were you under training at Harrogate? Was there any training going on, or was this just...
It was just to keep us occupied, really. There's no real training going on. But
no duties?
No duties that I can remember, no. No, we were more or less left to our own resources for most of the time, as long as we behaved ourselves.